tense, I'm going to remind you of what we discussed, but in more compact notation. I have a caveat threefold. I'm going to take the field for my Kadirov-Spencer action is a 0-1 form valued in the tangent bundle. So it looks like mu I bar j dz bar I del bar. So in coordinates, it looks like that. But because I have a holomorphic volume form, I can identify this with the exterior square of the cotangent bundle. So you can also be thought of as a 2-1 form. And then we have a constraint. Where del mu is a 3-1 form, which is the same as a 0-1 form. And the Lagrangian takes this form. So last time I wrote it in coordinates, and the interaction was looked like this. I said the kinetic term looks like this. And then there's a cubic term which has maybe 1 over 6 times mu cubed. So to be a little more precise, so when I wrote it in coordinates, this mu cubed, I just cubed this expression, and I contracted all the indices with epsilon tensors. So here, mu cubed is in the 0-3 form. Coefficients in the exterior cube, and that's the same as, because I have a volume form, the exterior cube is trivial. So it's a 3-3 form, therefore it's something I can integrate. But, if you're uncomfortable with these kind of global manipulations of tensors, just think about it as I'm just contracting the indices using the epsilon tensor coordinates, and having a volume form means I have an epsilon tensor.
So, and sorry, what was the last claim to equate a 0-3 with a 3-3?
Yeah.
What was that last claim, sorry?
Just because I have a volume form.
Okay.
So I have something like dz1, dz2, dz3. So I can multiply that by my 0-3 form to get a 3-3 form.
Okay. I have a volume form. Oh, the volume form is some sort of.
So the volume form is a trivialization of the 3-0 thing.
But usually I imagine a volume form as having six things, like dz, dz1 is this,
sorry. Holomorphic volume form. Holomorphic volume form has three things.
Okay.
So it trivializes the exterior cube of either the tangent or cotangent.
And what was the first relation that started everything? I remember the 0,1 is equal to something. I can't see.
Okay, 0,1 is equal to
some exterior power.
Yeah, so that's just that I can take dzi and contract it with d3z. And that gives me kind of epsilon ijk. Give me this at all.
Is it some Hutch star generalization? Oh, no, it's an evaluation.
Think about like ordinary calculus, right?
Okay.
If I'm on R3, a vector field and a 2 form are the same thing.
Sure, okay.
Right? This is why you have, like, I don't know.
Yeah, it's fine.
This is why you have the cross product.
Yeah.
Two vectors, it's a 2 form, I turn into another vector. So it's really.
Just that, yes.
It's just ordinary calculus.
Three-dimensional accident, okay.
Yeah. So Kadirov-Spencer theory has two other fields. which are not as important. And we're actually not really going to dwell on them. I'm going to say alpha I so they're fermions. So they're of odd parity. And there's two of them. And the Lagrangian is integral epsilon ij alpha I d bar sub mu alpha j. So it's just some kind of BC type system coupled covariantly to this variation. Another way to think about this is if x is a CY3, then spinners in x are S plus the even and S minus omega 0 odd. And the Dirac operator is d bar plus d bar star. You guys know this? If you don't know this, you should. It's a really basic fact that you should go read about. Like, how do spinners, which are a representation of SO2n, transform under the subgroup SUn? And once you have SUn, I can polarize my vectors into raising and lowering operators, which are d by dz, d by dz bar, and I can generate my spinners by hitting them with, say, the raising operators. If I hit them with an even number, I get one of the two representations, an odd number, I get the other representation, and the Dirac operator is this very simple form. So you can see that this is, these are odd 0-1 forms, so they literally are parts of spinners. So these come from some spinners. And this first order action is, a piece of the usual first order action for spinners.
So regarding the claim about the spinners, first of all, is it a claim about spinners in six real D, three complex D, or?
It's on any complex manifold with a volume form. So if we just work on flat space, it's a claim about spinners in dimension 2n. It's a representation of SO2n. How do they transform under SUn, which is a subgroup?
SO2n. I didn't hear that.
The space of spinners is a dimension. Representation of SO2n is a dimension 2 to the n over 2 to the n or something like that. And you can see it as the exterior powers of, the vector representation breaks into two pieces under SUn, and the spinners are the exterior powers of one of those pieces.
And so just because I remember from the Clifford algebra, one could see that, and even dimensions things decompose into left-handed and right-handed.
Exactly, and that's this decomposition.
So it's not only for Dirac spinners, but in general for representations of SON, this decomposition happens in even n.
And when you restrict to the subgroup, you decompose even further.
Okay.
So which means when I'm in a global manifold, if I have holonomy in that subgroup, my spinners decompose even further.
Okay.
Which is why. I keep getting distracted, which is why on a Calabi-Yau manifold, because in here I have 0, 0, I have a canonical spinner on any Calabi-Yau manifold. So that's why Calabi-Yau manifolds have supersymmetry. If there's a covariant constant spinner. So there's a fun game. You could take, I decompose my spinners in dimension 7 into a representation of G2. There's one thing which is fixed by G2. So G2 manifolds have a covariant constant spinner. And so on. Where were we?
And one last thing to confirm, the d bar mu is the covariant derivative with mu the connection.
Yeah, exactly. So I just put that operator in.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, how do we understand, like, what's the meaning of this? Oh, yeah, So I'm not going to talk about these fields alpha and beta quite so much, because they're just kind of along for the ride. The really important one is this ultrami differential. So gauge symmetry. If I take x, not x, I'll call it, say, v, omega 0, 0, is a vector field pointing in the d by dz directions. Then, you know, in gravity, you want to gauge by diffeomorphisms, and infinitesimally, diffeomorphisms are vector fields. And when you gauge by them, they just act on all the fields just by coordinate transformation, which is Lie derivative for vector fields. So Lie derivative. So delta mu is going to be just a commutator. This is just the commutator of V with this d bar sub mu operator. So you might be concerned that in ordinary gravity, here I'm dividing it by 3 of the 6 types of vector fields, whereas in ordinary gravity, we divide it by all 6. So this is a slightly funny gravitational theory. And to get a feeling for it, I want to describe what it looks like. Suppose x is c star cubed, where c star is complex line minus the origin, which I want to think of as a cylinder. Then I want to do KK reduction to R cubed along S1 cubed. Okay, what do we get? So the result is ordinary three-dimensional Chern-Simons theory for the group of volume preserving diffeos of this source. So how does this work? So my 0-1 form upstairs these dz bars, these become the three components of my 3D gauge field. Whereas the vector fields become the Chern-Simons gauge transformations. Okay, so I don't know if that's helpful. I find this helpful because, well, it tells you it's not quite for gravitational theory in the usual sense. Like when we do this KK reduction, you know, I've absorbed I've kind of three of the six components of diffeomorphisms, and they can be thought of as all acting on this fiber when I do this KK reduction. And you don't, the 3D diffeomorphisms are no longer gauged. In fact, this is more, there's a lecture of Nekrasov somewhere on the Simons Center website where he does an analysis of this Kadare-Spencer theory, but in 3.3 signature, and there's a general picture like this, where it's always Chern-Simons theory valued in diffeomorphisms of some 3 manifold. So in a sense, it's like a fluid or something. Okay. So the next thing I want to discuss is brains and then back reaction.
Can I just ask this question? So on this, at the end of the reduction, we just get a Chern-Simons theory with the gauge group being the volume preserving the diffuse.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
So to start with, we had 3 vector fields that generated the algebra of the gauge transformations.
Mm-hmm.
We had only 3, and so what happened here, first we were in some manifold X, and then we went, okay, X was this guy. I also don't know what a KK reduction is, Kaluza Klein, I presume, but what is the main conclusion that I should get from this? That if I'm failing to grasp it, really.
Let's see. I think maybe the main conclusion will be cleaner if I move to 3.3 signature, so that these vector fields are all real. So Z and Z bar are then independent, 6 independent real coordinates.
Yes, but there would still be 3 vector fields.
This would be 3 vector fields.
Okay.
And then you find, you have a funny gravitational type theory, but I'm only gauging diffeomorphisms in 3 directions.
Okay.
And from the other tree, it looks like, so I can think of the 3 directions I'm gauging the diffeomorphisms, and the other 3, I have a gauge field. So I have a gauge theory valued in the group of diffeomorphisms.
Sir, do I understand correctly that like your gauge transformation is only homomorphic vector fields, right?
Well, I'm not asking that d bar of v is zero.
Okay, but d or dz is homomorphic.
They point in the dz directions, but they may have smooth coefficients.
So they belong to sections like t1, 0.
Exactly.
Okay. And I didn't get how after Kaluza Klein reduction, how it happened that we don't have like anything in the direction of R3 only on.
Okay, so I'm being a little sloppy, and maybe the cleaner statement is the one Microsoft makes where you go past a 3.3 signature. But this one is also true, though, but what happens is that you have. You have a particular background gauge field because moving along the radial direction and the angular direction are linked.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a background gauge field that looks like D or I.
I mean, this is 1 C star, yes?
Yes, and a particular C star, you turn on this background gauge field. And it's
mm-hmm.
necessary.
So it's Chern-Simons theory of this infinite dimensional gauge group.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Of course, you can't actually make sense of that, right, at the quantum level, because you immediately run into kind of crazy divergences. And
mm-hmm. okay.
But yeah, I thought the kind of cool direction, and Nikita and Surya were looking at this, is Chern-Simons theory is really related to sigma models.
Mm-hmm.
And sigma models with diffeomorphisms, that's so close to Arnold's description of a fluid.
Yes.
Okay. So again, I think X minus C by 3. So from the math perspective, brains are coherent sheaves on X. I'm not going to talk about that. But from a more concrete perspective, the brain is given by y inside of x, y is a holomorphic submanifold, and E, a vector bundle on Y. Say it has to be holomorphic. So these brains like really come from the physical string. Suppose I'm on the physical string, I'll just take X to be flat space. So on the physical string, you might have, say, a D7, which drops this. Topological string, you get a space-filling brain. I'll call it a D5. So I should warn you, there's the conventions, you know, in the physical string, a brain which wraps 8 space-time dimensions is a D7 brain. You always add 1 for time. So in the topological string, the conventions vary between authors. Because, well, so my convention is going to be I'm also going to add 1 to the dimension. This is a space-filling brain wraps D5, so it wraps all of C3. I have a D5, which wraps, say, it becomes a D3, which wraps a complex dimension 2, wraps a copy of C2, and a D3, it's always going to wrap the omega background plane. There's a D1, which wraps C. D minus 1. That's the point. So today, and for this lecture course in general, we're only going to be interested in the D3 mostly. So that wraps curve inside of C3. So brains, of course, have degrees of freedom. And well, they carry gauge fields, which I'll discuss next time. And they also couple to supergravity. So for example, I take the D3 in the physical string. Suppose I take this is the 5-form field strength. So this is self-dual and closed. The coupling is the integral or the real volume of the D3 of D inverse F5. Plus other stuff, which is determined by supersymmetry. So, if we forget about the degrees of freedom on the brain for a minute, like forget about the gauge fields, like what they do, one of the things they do is they provide something like Wilson lines on which I can integrate my Ramondamon charges. So,
the Wilson line is in the world volume.
What's that?
Where is the Wilson line? It's in the world volume.
The world volume of the brain, exactly. So if we were in type 2A, type 2A has a gauge field, like a Ramondamon one form, and if I inserted a D0, that's literally a Wilson line. For that E1 gauge field. Plus, you know, supersymmetric corrections. So I want to do the same thing in the topological string. So to do that, I want to, you know, last time we were talking about how this field mu, this Beltrami differential on the topological string, we can think of it as a part of the metric. But we can also think of it as a part of the phi form. So this guy and G are related by supersymmetry. And to understand these kind of fluxes and so on, it's much easier to use the phi form. So to say they're related by supersymmetry is that if I'm on a background which has supersymmetry and I've turned on this guy, then I'm forced to have this as well. For instance, ADS5 times S5 is not a Ricci flat manifold, but it still satisfies the equations of motion because of this phi form flux. So there's a relationship between the Ricci curvature and that. Where were we? Okay, so we can think of mu, viewed as a 2-1 form, as coming from the phi form field strength instead. So roughly, mu is integral over or to epsilon this guy. So this is kind of cartoon. I remove two of the directions, and then this is a 3-form. You know, 2-1 forms are self-dual or maybe anti-self-dual, depending on your conventions. That's going to be related to the self-duality of that. Okay, so this was just kind of to motivate the how does the mu couple to a D1. So we propose, and this proposal can be justified in various ways. I mean, you can derive it from the world sheet. But I wanted to derive it by analogy with the physical string. That mu couples to a D1 wrapping a curve inside of a threefold integral of the curve of del inverse mu, or del inverse mu is a 1-1 form of x. So what I want you to take away is This is really, really closely related to this. It's pretty much the same formula as we find for the coupling of the D3.
So do you have there R2 epsilon or R2 minus epsilon? Because like there.
Oh. I'm not going to keep these straight. So.
Yeah, but I mean. Like,
oh yeah, it should be if I'm using minus epsilon over there, it should be minus epsilon here too.
So like you're integrating of the cycle, which is the brain.
Exactly. Okay, any other questions? Yeah.
Can you consider brains that wrap both R epsilon, R squared epsilon, R, like those two planes on some code?
No, they turn out not to be supersymmetric. I mean, you can do what you want in the physical string, but they'll only exist in the topological string if they have enough supersymmetry. And those ones don't. In fact, this one also doesn't really exist except at tree level, because when I have this R2 epsilon, this is effectively a compact geometry. We should think of it like that. And there's nowhere for the flux that this would source to go. Like if this was a two-sphere, for example, there's nowhere for the flux with 87 to go, and similarly with this equivariant geometry.
Can you explain why we should think it as a compact geometry? I think I don't understand.
I don't have a great physical answer. I mean, the way I think about it is, you know, I'm instead of looking at differential forms here, I'm looking at equivariant differential forms. And then when I do integrals, they're computed by passing the equivariant localization, which means I'm only going to see the neighborhood of the origin. So in Nekrasov's original papers on the omega background, there's probably some other more physical explanation, which I don't remember, and maybe somebody else does, but. So we'd like to look at the field sourced by mu. So let's just do this in the physical string quickly. If we're going to back react, we look at the field sourced by the D3. So the equations of motion in the presence of n D3s, well, you have this kind of Lagrangian integral D3 n times d inverse 5 plus integral 5 squared we find equations of motion are that d of this guy is the delta function on the locus of the D3 world volume. Okay, so what does that mean? Implies that if I integrate, say the Cauchy's coordinates, say x 0, x 3, and y 4, y 9, this is on the D3, the integral over the y equals 1 of this guy is n. So there's a flux of n as I integrate my, sorry, not dfi. As I integrate my 5 form along the 5-sphere linking. So, okay, of course there's other terms given by the metric, but in principle these are determined by supersymmetry, and one is led to after some work, to ADS5 times S5 with a 5 form F, where the integral on S5 F is M. Okay, so let's just try and do the same thing in the topological tree.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Just so I make sure I understand the basic point is that we can understand the differential mu on the Calabi-Yau as being sourced by, like, as coming from as an integral by form sourced by D3 brain and theory.
Yes.
And you can also, so once you do that, you can also play the game of adding n D3s and then seeing what the resulting.
Yes, and that's just a factor of n in the equation.
But then you set up to some metric corrections.
The topological string is simpler. Like that formula for the topological string is exact. Whereas in the physical string, if I wanted to actually write down all the couplings to the D3, it's going to be kind of messy. The reason the topological string is simpler is that the other terms in the physical string are determined in principle by supersymmetry. So, so if you wanted to arrive at the back-reacted geometry, you presumably, although I haven't done this, could say, oh, I just want to have some geometry with a five-form flux. And then the metric has to, properties of the metric are going to be determined by this, more or less. It has to have certain supersymmetry. So, yeah, I'm not sure it's the cleanest way to explain all this, but so the thing I wanted to get to is just want to compute what we get if we study the thing sourced by the brain. Similarly, so in the topological string, if I have n D1s, then the equation for mu is D bar mu is the delta function looks at the D1s times n. So I'm going to choose coordinates z, W1, W2. Z is where the D1 or volume. And these guys, these are the normal coordinates. So let's solve this equation. So if we were in complex dimension 1, I think everybody would know how to solve this. D bar of 1 over z is delta function. But that formula has a natural generalization. It's called the Bochner-Martinelli kernel. So the solution to this equation and times n. So how do I know that this solves this equation? Well, you can go read it in the textbook somewhere, or look in the Wikipedia page, or you can check. Firstly, d bar mu is equal to 0, except at wi equals 0, and 2, the integral of the 5-sphere is basically equal to n times some kind of factors of pi. I didn't get the normalization. So these are two little checks you can do at home if you want to. And neither of them are hard. And these properties imply this equation.
Sorry, did you say that in standard setup in physical string theory we can only solve equations for f and from that recover like metric and everything using supersymmetry?
I believe so.
Okay.
I wouldn't bet my life on it, but I think that's I think that's one way to get there.
And here we only solve like equation for mu, and basically we don't have any other bosonic fields.
Exactly.
We're fine.
Because mu can be thought of as either the metric or f. Because we're only looking at supersymmetric variations and they're related.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So Hewitt takes a near horizon limit. Why is there no limit there?
Yeah, ask Davide. You know. I'm almost confused. I mean, like once we back react, you get something you can't do a near horizon limit to anymore. So but I'm not really sure why. And it's probably to do with some parameter in the physical string that is absent in the topological string, like alpha prime or something like that. But okay, so we accept that this expression gives me my back reaction. Let's turn it back into a Beltrami differential and see how the geometry changes.
But initially, you put the stack of given brains on flat space. It's just C3.
Exactly, yes.
Okay.
So. When I turn it into a Beltrami differential, you know, dW1, dW2 turns into del z. That's how we go from two forms to vectors. So holomorphic functions in the deformed geometry satisfy following equations, say d bar f plus n equals 0. So we can unpack this a little bit. So this is like df dw bar 2 plus n w bar 1 over so these are this and five. Equations. So we want to find, you know, it should be a three-dimensional geometry. We want to find three functions satisfying these equations. So clearly, if I have a function that doesn't depend on z, and only depends on w1, w2, that will work.
Okay, but basically, I was imagining that we have n d3 brains and the 10d.
Mm-hmm.
How did we get to the D1 brains?
Right, so if I have the D3 brains in 10D, they wrap this OR2 epsilon plane, so they become a brain in the topological string.
Ah, okay.
So that brain is called a D1 brain, although the terminology is confusing. Okay, so let's, at this stage, it's really just an elementary exercise in calculus to go away and try to figure out solutions to these equations. So two solutions are f equals w1, f equals w2, and two more are, I'm going to call, say, u1. One is equal to W1V. It's like a 50% chance of me getting the sign wrong here. So how does this work? If I take this guy, I look at the second term where I differentiate with respect to z, I'll find this thing with the 1 over w to the fourth. And some w bar and some w on the top. And if I take this term and if differentiate with respect to w bar, I'm going to get it 1 over w to the fourth and some similar stuff. And you just do the calculation and it all cancels if I got the sign correct. So, however, these are four coordinates. On the 3D geometry. So they're redundant. There should be one relation. And indeed there is. If I take w1 u2 minus w2 u1, w1 u2, I get this ww bar. w2 u1, I get that ww bar. That's going to be minus n. So what we found is just by mimicking the physical string leads you by some complicated process, including back reaction, which I don't really understand, including near horizon limit, which I find a bit confusing, to ADS5 times S5. Here we're led to this geometry. So this is given by 2x2 matrices. Of determinant, well, minus a. Yeah.
I think I don't understand the physical, like the geometric meaning of that formula where you integrate the phi form from the physical string point of view and you get n. Mm-hmm. And similarly, why the constraint is the determinant is n or minus n.
So like this formula here where the flux is n. Let's see if there's a better way to think about it. Well, let's go to the 2a string. Things are a little easier maybe. And I suppose I have a D0 brain with some line. So in the 2a string, I have a gauge field. And that line is just a Wilson line with a gauge field. So I think it's reasonable that if I had n D0 brains, I'm just going to take the nth power of that. So I get a factor of n when I integrate my gauge field. So if you're okay with the factor of n here, you can certainly derive this one. Are you okay with this one?
If I have that, then I can try this.
Yes. So this equation implies this one because if I integrate over the region where y is less than or equal to 1 of df, on the one hand, I'd pick up an n because it's a delta function. But then also by Stokes' theorem, so is that convincing? I mean, there's other ways to think about it.
I'm sort of trying to understand, sort of I guess we should be able to define the geometry independent of whether we think of it, whether we think of mu coming from a stack of D brains and in a physical theory, right?
Yes. I could have just started with a formula for how mu couples to a D1 integral over del inverse of mu.
So from that point of view, I'm trying to understand why the where the n appears.
So the n appears because I see. So I neglected to write down something. So we have our kinetic term and the term where we couple to n brains. Now if I vary mu, so slightly tricky because of the d bar inverses, but you're led to the equation that d bar mu, what you're led to immediately is d bar del inverse mu is del inverse of a delta function and n. Then I make both sides of del inverse, or del, sorry. Is that better? Because I think, that was a piece I forgot to write. So that's just analogous to deriving this equation from this one.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask, so you deformed the complex. So mu defines the deformation of the complex structure given the equation. So we found that solution, or rather, we found that solution.
Mm-hmm.
And now we find, what are the holomorphic functions under this new definition of a complex structure? And we found its coordinates. Is that a general philosophy, that we find holomorphic functions and see if they have some sort of algebraic relation to find what manifold they define?
Yeah, absolutely.
And why was it that we stumbled upon, I imagine there are many holomorphic functions you could have found, but we stumbled upon the coordinates themselves.
Well, you want to, I could have started with W1 to the 50 and so on.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have formed a good coordinate system. So I want to start with something which forms a good coordinate system before I deformed. So I want to start as close as I possibly can to W1, W2, and Z.
Okay. What solutions are, it says?
The two solutions are F equals W1, F equals W2, and then there's two more.
Okay.
What you want is you want to get the collection of functions so that every other holomorphic function is written as a sum of products of these guys. So they generate all of them. Okay, so the punchline is here.
That's my cast. I need a question. I think I'm a little confused. Before wrapping this D1 brain, I'm just looking for deformation of complex structure. Now, of the whole manifold.
Yes.
Now, turning this on means I'm only looking for deformation of complex structure away from this brain, where this brain is, with this very specific equation of motion. All of a sudden, there's a unique one.
There's not a unique one.
You wrote down this mu.
I wrote down this mu, but actually, it was an ace.
You could have added any other thing.
I could have added anything holomorphic. There is a unique one which decays rapidly. Well,
this is a unique one.
There's a unique one that's homogeneous, that falls off it. Exactly.
What happens if you? I guess, let's see. You're just looking at this single point in the that satisfy equation of motion. You're not saying anything general about like.
I think every other one. Yeah, every other solution to the equations of motion will be gauge trivial. You can remove it because the interaction doesn't really matter. So this is just a problem of Dalbach homology. So all I'm saying is, if I want to have something where d bar of it is a delta function, there is a unique such thing up to d bar exact stuff.
So remember, I had to ask this question before, but how we did get rid of nonlinear term, of quadratic term?
It just so happens that in this particular case, that mu brackets mu is zero, just because this only has a del z in it, it doesn't have any other derivatives.
So it's just a result of computation that you can solve linear rest equation and it appears to be a solution to the linear one.
Yeah. Okay. So if you were to try to do this in some complicated Clavier threefold, it would be more, would be much harder.
The AES 5 times S5 solution is like the solution for the geometry of 10D space, but here we are only doing the 6D.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Like these are all coordinates in X?
Yes. Well, so I mean, you could ask, how does ADS 5 times S5 relate to this geometry? Well, I have to explain what this geometry is. I mean, in another way. So this is gives group manifold SL2C, which if you prefer, you can think of as SL3-1 with some complex structure. And this is also equal to Euclidean ADS3 times S3, because SO3-1 is the isometries H3, and so we get an S3 bundle. Now this rotates H3, and then if I look at the things which fix a particular point, it's a copy of SU2. So it's a copy of SU2. So that's S3 bundle over H3.
So what is H3?
Hyperbolic three space.
So that's quaternion.
What is it?
I mean, H is also quaternion.
Oh, yes, sorry, yes. Oh. So this is, it's really like Euclidean ADS3 times S3. Hold on a sec, I just gotta check my phone. Great. So what the expectation is that DS3 times S3 is inside of ADS5 times S5, and that 2B here kind of localizes the B model here. So this is a bit, the status of this is much less clear because it's kind of harder to compute this kind of things on a background such as this than it is on flat space. But I think it's not out of reach. to really prove that correctly. Okay, I think I should stop there.